Welcome to Cloudlandia, Mr. Sullivan.
Ah, Mr. Jackson.
Welcome.
You know, a half hour.
Cloudlandia.
Yes, a half hour is not too much to wait for this.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I did your breakfast. I mean, is that the reason?
Yeah, everything worked out. That's perfect. Thank you. That's so funny. It's interesting. I've had an interesting word combination come to me that I've been contemplating for the last 24 hours or so. And the words are insufficiently bullish. And I thought to myself, that is an interesting thought. However, it was expressed in terms of NFTs. And crypto,
yes.
Blockchain.
Yes.
If however bullish you are on it, you are insufficiently bullish. And I was thinking about that, as bullish as we are on the free zone frontier and Cloudlandia, we are insufficiently bullish with a 2030 perspective.
2030.
Yeah, if our target is the year 2030 from a vista of 2021. I believe that as exciting as it all sounds and as, you know, effusive as we are about it, that I think we are, the more I look at it and think about it, insufficiently bullish on the future of the free zone and Cloudlandia, of which NFTs and blockchain and all that will be a part. But I just look at it, man.
You know, it's really interesting. I just did a fascinating book called Apocalypse Never by Michael Schellenberger.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna buy it for everybody in 10 times for December. And he's a former, very significant environmental, and almost on the extreme side, going back to the 80s, and he's done a switch, which is a very interesting thing that I've followed for 30 years, that I've only met people who were at one time on the political left who have moved right, but I've never met anyone on the political right who has moved left, you know, in my entire life. Now, that just may be my personal experience, you know. That people who were on the right moved up probably don't want to.
Hillary Clinton will try and tell you that she is one of those people.
Oh, no.
Hillary.
No. Here's the truth about Hillary. Hillary will be whoever you want her to be.
Well, that's why I'm saying. I just wanted to point out.
Minute by minute. But
she made
Hillary
a point of growing up as.
Yeah, but Hillary can move positions and move personalities.
Oh, yeah.
Faster than Superman. You know, I mean, she can be in the costume.
She'll tell you that's what rooted her in her, that Southern conservative, she's got that in her roots.
No.
She saw this in a more inclusive way.
Hillary doesn't remember who she was an hour ago, and she doesn't know who she was an hour ago. Power in the future. It's whatever the situation calls for. But the Bill always knows who he is.
Uh-huh. Right.
I always say they had the perfect collaboration for 30 years. Bill just had a good time. He created all the good times and she cleaned up all the messes. It was a perfect collaboration.
Mm.
And anyway, but the Michael Schellenberger book is really fascinating. One of the things that he talks about there is that the environmental movement, it's almost entirely consists of highly educated, affluent Westerners who live in prosperous countries. Okay. And the impact of their policies would be to prevent any poor country from getting richer.
Mm-hmm. I wonder now it's the tax that was just agreed on, or in theory, the global minimum income tax. or this corporate tax. That, I think, that's going one step closer to acceptance of decentralized finance in a way, right? Like moving closer to there being a crypto type of digital currency that everybody's on board with.
Yeah, but here's the point about that. Now the corporate tax in the United States, would you go for 15%?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would. I totally would.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a joke. You can't go below 15%, you know, with your corporate income. Name the country in the world except for maybe Singapore, maybe Ireland, maybe the other countries that's ever been below 15%. The vast majority of them wrapped around 30%. I'd go for 15%. Why don't we just make it uniform 15% around the world right now? That solve a lot of problems. Yeah, so, I don't know. I don't think change happens really at that level. You know, I think it happens at the level of, you know, maybe 500 million people operating for about 10 years without being observed by government.
Right.
That would really change that. I think that's already changing the world. You and I have been living for the last year and a half, especially the last year and a half, in a secret, invisible, undetectable world.
Yes, that is true.
I'm telling people who are doing it about it, but I'm not telling people who aren't doing it about it.
Yeah, that whole, it's so amazing to look at it, even in this perspective, though, I'm also, you know, as excited as I am about 2030, I'm often looking back. Like, I just watched the new series now, just started, The Engineering That Made Us. And it was started out with the railroad again. Mm-hmm. And so back another perspective on the railroad thing, and really free zone collaboration between the government and the, you know, two railroads that made the transcontinental railroad happen, and the exchange of, they got rich from not the fees they were paid for, but the real estate. You've mentioned it before.
Yeah.
And that whole, now that was the foundation there. And you see then, I'm interested in where in this, like, what are we going to be talking about in 2030 as we look back on the current state of where we are right now? Like, as, you know, what's an NFT? That's the equivalent of that Bryant Gumbel. What is internet? You know, that was when they got that sound bite, that would make a really good NFT, actually. Somebody to have that piece.
You know, the biggest change, from my perception, you know, having, you know, I'm in my, completing my eighth decade, so I've got a little bit of history, you know, in terms of my own personal experience. And there's a very famous book. It's a history of science book by a man by the name of Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N. And it's called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Came out in the 60s, 70s. And he's the one who coined the term paradigm shift. And so he says a paradigm is a way of thinking about things that sort of dominates, you know, kind of the general situation, you know, during any given time. And he says this happens in all fields of activity, but it happens in science too, that you'll have certain ideas about science that have been the product of scientists or physicists who became very famous. Darwin would be an example. Einstein would be another example. That,
yes,
they're good. They've got a shelf life. In other words, that they might last 40, 50, they might last for 100 years. And they give room and they give structure and kind of direction for a lot of people to make a lot of progress. But as they get, you know, at a certain stage of shelf life, they start not the things that they don't answer starts accumulating, and after a while, younger people coming along say, you know, what we're learning doesn't really explain what we see going on. And of course, the younger people are having a totally different experience than the older experience. The older experience have had success. They've got position. They've got security. Mm-hmm. They've got influence. And the younger people don't have any of this, but the younger ones have new ideas. And he says, and all at once, a new idea will come along and it becomes extraordinarily disruptive. And he said, but it'll be resisted. It'll be very strongly mm-hmm. resisted by those in the establishment. And mm-hmm. he said, therefore, the single biggest factor for scientific breakthroughs from one paradigm to another is the funerals of old scientists.
Mm, interesting.
It's only when that older generation dies, then there's room for the new people. There's new ideas. And the biggest factor that's going to change 2030 and make it very different from 2020 is the death of the baby boom generation as an important factor in society.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing,
we were mentioning Hillary's whole generation, who were the anti-war generation during the 1960s. Yeah. They'll all be tired, tired, fired, dead, retired by 2030. They'll have no influence. This is their last kick. Joe Biden is a member of that generation. He was elected with only 20% left on his batteries. He's got about 2 good hours a day, probably, he has to be protected. Well, that whole generation, Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, and everything.
Yes.
And probably the only exception to the rule is probably Trump. Trump looks better now than he did 10 years ago. I mean, mm-hmm. Trump, he's got a different kind of energy. But the other thing is that he's got ideas that are totally opposed to the baby boom establishment. And I'm interested in it because I'm actually older than the baby boom generation. I was born.
Yeah, you're the silent generation, right?
I'm a silent guy.
Yeah. But you're close enough to the baby boom that you're on the right on the, you're the tail, you're this, what do we call it? You're the leading edge of the silent generation, right?
Actually,
there's a big gap.
Actually, I was first in line for everything that was good for the baby boom generation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. As they were planning
when I got
ahead,
into
saying we're going to need. All
yeah. When I got into school, there was massive amount of personal attention you could get from teachers because they had been planning on a much bigger classes. When I got into the job market, there were far more jobs than there were people to take them. And so my whole life has been, I got into real estate at the right time. You know, it's kind of like almost everything. I got into entrepreneurism at the right time. So the big thing, a lot of people talk about technology and they talk about this, but they don't talk about demographics. And I think demographics are the single biggest, most powerful change factor that hardly anyone pays any attention to.
I agree. Yeah. And I look at that, like if you just look at the chart of birth rates.
What are you, by the way? You're a...
So I am the leading, I was 1966, so... I am Generation X. I'm the beginning of Generation X. And so I'm an elder Generation X. But mm-hmm. close enough to the the young, you know, there's always this.
You're on the other side of the book. You're 2 years on the other side of the boomers following. I'm 2 years before the boomers ahead of.
That's right. So we bookend the boomers, you and I, 22 years apart, you and I.
Yeah.
And so, but what's interesting is if you just look at demographically what's happening after the baby boomers, it's all the silent generation, what you were all through the Depression and the leading up to the war, birth rates were way down compared to the GI generation in the 20s, right?
And yes. Yeah.
The ones who are, it's the very, very tail end of the GI generation
they're dying off,
alive, you know, still. I mean, they're all dying off now. And there's going to be a big gap of people who, I think, for two reasons. First of all, your generation, you know, you're closer to the baby boom. Your end of the silent generation was more like the baby boom than like the silent generation, I would say, in that you have gravitated, you've benefited from the good.
I didn't really have my parents in their entire lifetime were in their most secure, comfortable position the year that I was born. I think probably in their entire life. My father worked in a war factory, so he was exempt from the military draft because he already had four children before the war started in Pearl Harbor. And he was already working in a war factory when that happened, so he was completely exempt. And, you know, I'll send you an article. It's a description of the war factory that he worked in, Cleveland, Ohio. They went from around 150 employees to about 2,500 employees in about 6 months. And they made gyroscopes for airplanes. And, I mean, people would dream about having the perks that they had in that factory in 1940s that my father had. But my father was an entrepreneur. You know, he grew up on a farm, one had his own farm. And, you know, as soon as the war was over, he quit. And they offered him a huge, you know, bonus if he would stay on, and especially if he would move to California, because they moved most of the big defense corporations moved to California after the Second World War from the Midwest. They moved out there, and he said, "I can't stand it." He says, "I can't stand, you know, working in that." So that's when he made his break, but it was tough. I mean, the farm failed after, you know, and they moved in 46, started the farm, failed in 55, and he reinvented himself as a landscaper, and he did well, but never. Mm-hmm. Financially, they never did as well as they did during the war, you know. And I mean, the government was paying everybody during the war, you know. I mean, it was like the last, you know, a little bit. People got a little taste of this during the last 2 years of COVID, but during the Second World War, it was, you know, the government paid for everything, every crop, every vegetable, every fruit, every thing that the farmers raised, the government bought it right away. I mean, you couldn't fail during the Second World War.
Right.
The government bought everything. Yeah. So I was born during really good times, you know, and I've lived my life. I've really lived my life during really good times. Mm-hmm. At any given time, some people are having good times and some people are having bad times. And my experience is the only bad times I've had in my life, it was my own fault.
Right, that's true. Somebody's having it. That was one thing, that's what we learned in tennis, that every shot makes somebody happy. Right, so that's the... every shot makes somebody happy. So that's kind of good. You just look for, you can shapeshift and be happy.
I don't care if you have the top two players in the world, at any given time, one of them is under average.
That's exactly right. Slightly under average. But that was, yeah. But this whole, getting back to your demographic thing, that what's noticeable is between, you know, right before you, the birth rate was really low from 1930 to 1942, you know, ish kind of thing.
Started and going down really started going down. It took the depression. I mean, they talk about the stock market crash as if the depression started in one day. It actually happened over about 30 months, you know, the 30 months. And there was a stock market crash, but the market came back up. And then there'd be little crashes and everything else. But the problem was they didn't have a banking system that could keep the economy supplied with cash.
Right.
There was no there was no bank insurance in those days. Banks, nothing is demoralizing as the bank that you have all your cash in going bankrupt.
Right. Yeah, and that's, of course, less than 100 years ago now. And I mean, amazing how far we've come. But right after my generation started, that we were the first generation where they were literally taking pills to not have us. And it worked. And there was far fewer of us than the generations prior. And gap till you get to the, you know, millennials. But that 15-year generation, you know, from 1965 to 1981, Generation X there, that is much smaller as a cohort than either the baby boomers or the millennials. I mean, it's like this little desert in the birth rate, you know, chart. Mm-hmm. And those things make a difference. Like when you look at, you know, you look at the, I was like Harry Dent is
boomer born gutting industrial.
Yeah.
You know, it was just the massacre of industrial jobs and industries and cities in the United States that,
Yeah, Harry Dent is where I first learned about this, like back in the 90s when I first heard about Harry. And then I love, you know, the joke about Harry now is that he's predictably, he's successfully predicted two of
He's he works on the broken clock theory, you know, twice a day a broken clock is correct.
Exactly. See, I said it. I said it was going to come just like that. The man who predicted it.
I mean,
I think even he would agree that we are. I even think he might agree that we are insufficiently bullish on the 2030 free zone future. Powered by Cloudlandia.
Here's a thing that I would predict for 2030 that is not being talked about now. There will be a growing consensus that nuclear power is the energy solution.
Mm-hmm. I think that's already among scientists. That is the truth, isn't it, already?
Yeah.
It's just, it's unfortunate. It's like what you say about
The thing is that they've been, you know, the people who are into nuclear science have been, you know, have had their back to the cliff now for since the 70s, you know, since the 70s. So it's going on 50 years. They've had their, you know, 1 foot. Some people are trying to. As a matter of fact, Michael Schellenberger in his book, Apocalypse Never, says that there's actually been a tacit agreement between the petroleum industry and the anti-fossil fuels industry to destroy the nuclear industry. And he gives, you know, whole chapters of agreements between people who say they're anti-fossil fuel, but they'd be totally in favor of a nuclear plant shutting down and being replaced with coal or natural gas or oil and everything else. And the reason is nuclear energy is really abundance energy. I mean, it really gets cheap when you get to the nuclear stage, because it lasts about 80 to 100 years with very almost no maintenance. For, you know, they just have to make sure that they're doing what they're doing. And it's emissions-free. There's no emissions-free. The storage of waste is a, you know, a well-established secret. There's been no incidents in the United States since they put in stations any of the waste causing contamination.
Total number of
deaths worldwide since 1953 directly caused by radiation, and that includes Chernobyl, is like 100. Like 100 people. You know. And the U.S. military, Navy, has been using nuclear since 1954 for
submarines,
aircraft carriers. No accidents whatsoever. I have a nephew who has 25 years or so. And I said, how frequently do they have to refuel? And he said, usually 7 or 8 years. You know, they can go 7 or 8 years between new fuel.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And they create all their own oxygen. They create all their water because they just take ocean water and run it over. They have to run the water over the...
Right.
Their own cool water. All, yeah. Their own oxygen. He said it's just humans that are the big cause. That's always the case, isn't it?
It really is. It's just
your household... Your household, I mean, take a look at your household there in Celebration. Isn't the big cost of humans?
That's right. It is. That's true. Yeah.
My company, you can run my company dirt cheap except for all the humans.
That's right. If it wasn't for the people and the paperwork. Yeah. It's true.
Like your customer base would be a cinch except for the humans, you know.
Yeah. That's exactly right in most cases. It is funny, though, that whole... Yeah, it is funny. But I just thought you would get a kick out of those words. Insufficiently bullish.
Maybe it was Bill Gates that said this. You know, he hasn't said much that I find is say. Everybody is over optimistic what you can get done a year, and totally underestimate what they can get done.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? Because you think about how even just we're living in a world right now that is almost unrecognizable or unimaginable from what it was 10 years ago.
2 years ago.
Even two years ago, you're absolutely right. Yeah. This isn't the start to whatever
you take
thought
one
the 20s
of our
would
podcasts,
bring.
We should just get the transcript of our podcast 2 years ago in October. Okay.
Yeah.
And see what we're talking about today. If you gave it to somebody and said, I don't know what happened between this first one and the second one, but there's a cool reality that they seem to be talking about in number two that they're not even aware of in number one.
That is true. I hadn't really thought about that, but that's really what so much of what we're talking about has really been impacted over the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and who knows even. That's the kind of thing, I guess. 10 years right now, I don't know whether you or Eben Pagan, I've had this conversation with about the actionable future. But 10 years feels like a little, it's not as actionable today as the 3-year kind of future, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, I was talking about this in the workshop. So I had 4 workshops last week. So, and I was saying, you know, one of the things I observed, and I said, during my lifetime, I was born in 1944. So, you know, during my lifetime, the population of the planet has gone up by 350%. Okay. So it's more than tripled. Population of the planet has tripled. And everybody is blaming change and disruption on everything. And I said, but nobody brings up the fact that the population of the planet tripled in size. I'm not talking about the impact on the environment or anything else. I'm just talking about having that many human beings get up in the morning and make decisions. It's not 3.5 times more complexity, you know, it's 1,000 times more complexity, 3 million times more complexity, you know, and unpredictability. So I think that the period in front of time waste for any of us, you, me, anybody, and we're good. I mean, you and I give probably more contemplation to what might happen in our lives ahead of us than the vast majority of people that I know. I mean, I think we're both, gazers at what lies ahead. We kind of gaze ahead and kind of pick out things that we like and us that we don't like. And, you know, we re-gauge our direction and all sorts of things. I would say our ability to do that in a actionable way, it has been divided maybe in half since we started our podcast series.
Has been what by half?
The actionable future that we have ahead of us has actually been cut in half since we started our actionable. So we might have been able to take action on something that was 3 years away. And my feeling is we'd be much more rewarded not to go out too much more than 1.5 years
with
actionable activities.
Yes, right.
And the reason is the general environment will change so much that a three year would be pretty worthless.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not anything about us. Both of us are getting better at what we do. It's just what you can be certain about, I think, is coming closer to you. On the other hand, you can be your ability to be in control of your response to uncertainty is going up at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think your VCR is the key to that. You know. Two things, who, not, how, and VCR. I think if you put the two of them together, there isn't that much you need to know. There isn't that
it
much
certainly
more
is
you need to know.
Right. It certainly is a great playbook, for sure.
Yeah. You know, I've got a goal. It's a what that we should achieve. I shouldn't do any of the house.
Right.
I don't
That's
care who
exactly
does that. I don't care who does the house.
Yeah.
Not me.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I just love that whole, so anything that's kind of illustrating those, you know, I've talked about the 8 profit activators and the breakthrough blueprint as durable context, like a music theory. Sort of thing, the theory that you can write all the other songs with, that the who, not, how, and the VCR formula are really that for, I think, the free zone, that when you look at it, that with that philosophy of who, not, how, and that structure of vision, capabilities, and reach, that all the things that are happening are a combination of those three components.
Mm-hmm.
That goes a long way.
Yeah, and the whole thing is it allows, you know, I mean, allows things. It allows you to be in your unique ability.
Yes.
Being pulled out, rather than being pulled out. And the other, what do I know that I'm not going to do in the future? I'm not going to do anything that's outside my ability. Do I know my unique ability? Yes, I have a pretty good handle on it. Would I know my unique ability 3 years from now? Yeah, I would. What about 10 years ago? I would, you know. So that's predictability. Okay. And I know I can take everything available to me and divide them into three columns. I got certain visions, personal and business. Yeah. I've got certain capabilities, personal and business. And I've got a lot of reach, personal and business. And once I get the capability and once halfway through the capability and reach, you know, business, not mine, they're other people's.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the greatest thing, is seeing them through other people's, being able to get things out of the world through others. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my sense is that what's dying in the world right now, I'm just watching it. You know, I was just looking at the popularity polls this morning. So Biden was 64% on election day. Or not on election day, inauguration day, he came into office at 64%, and we're 8 months down the road, 8, 9, I'm not sure how many months it is since inauguration day, and he's at 36. He's dropped 28 points. Not all the polls, but one poll where he was 64, he's now 36. That's a 28-point drop. You know, if he had jumped off the Washington Monument, he couldn't have gone down any faster.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's...
I don't think it has anything to do with him. It's the entire class of everything that he's been part of. And I don't, again, it's not personal. It's that entire baby boom generation that started taking power. You know, and, you know, they took power the moment they were born, you know, because they began, you know, all of a sudden advertisers became interested in six-year-olds, you know, rock and roll wouldn't have happened in the 1950s, except there were 10 or 12-year-old baby boomers who could, you know, who could pay cash for records. And, you know, they could buy shoes, they could buy clothes and everything like that. So from a consumer standpoint, the baby boomer generation has been in charge, you know, really since the mid-50s.
Yeah, I guess that is true, isn't it? I mean, that's right from being, because everybody was kind of paving the
way. Mickey Mouse Club.
For them.
Mickey Mouse Club.
Everything's been in service of the, you know what? I just saw something in a different light, but it certainly has been all eyes on us, the baby boomers.
Yeah.
Since that, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And it really strikes me, you know, I haven't watched television for three and a half years, but some of the advertising spills over to the internet and I pick up on it. And I said, why are the ads filled up with old geezers? I mean, there's all these people of gray-haired men and women.
They've got all the money.
Of all skin colors. And I said, it's exactly the same people that they were focusing on in 1956. They're just 65 years older.
Yes. I think that's true. I'm surprised
I looked back to see, you know, massive increase in advertising on funerals and cremations over the next 10 years.
I wonder.
Because they'll still be the big consumer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, until their dust settles, gets blown away in the wind, or the grass grows over, they're still, they're still spending, you know, and it's really, it's interesting how this one, and that was their big power. It was consumption power. It wasn't creative power. I don't think on a per capita basis for the number of them that there were, I don't think they were any more productive or, you know, creative other generations. As a matter of fact, maybe the, you know, there's particular generations. Maybe it was the greatest generation. Maybe they created more stuff, you know, on a per capita basis. But from a consumption standpoint, boy, the boomers, I mean, they're the all-time champs, I think, per capita, you know, in present dollars. I think they were the,
You look at now, even as they're aging now and getting into retirement, there's, you know, they're certainly the first generation to be embracing longevity kind of things more than my mom's generation. Like your my mom was born in 1936, so she was, she would be, you know, closing in on 85, I guess, right now, right? Yep. So you look at it, but she, in that early or that age, she was not hip to a Vasper machine or a, you know what I mean? You took, at that end, you had the baby boomer access mentality kind of thing with the, with money to be able to focus on longevity. Your experience at 77 is very different than what even 5 years ago someone's experience.
Well, it's different from it's different from almost anyone who's age.
But you're seeing now though that there are lots of people in their 70s who have been embracing longevity like this now. And not for nothing, but William Shatner, 90 years old, look at him. Going out in space. But that kind of thing now, you know, these...
Except for that guy, George, what's his name?
Takei.
Takei. I don't know if any of the cast is still alive except William Shatner. And it'd be interesting to go back and take a look at the cast and see how many of them are still alive.
George Takei is... And and so is William Shatner. But I think Spock died.
Leonard Nimoy.
Nimoy died.
Four or 5 years ago, I think. But it's very, really interesting. And
But I think this whole support, this brings in, you know, those, the people, the baby boomers now. This, I'm always looking at this, like Lee Iacocca would be looking at this group now with, you know, the big trail as they cross the 65-year, you know, mark, that there's, how are they going to, you know, ease into their 70s and go from there? And it's going to be an interesting, even services that allow them to, you know, being who's for all the things that stop people from staying in their home or doing all those things. I think what Lisa Simi is doing in terms of showcasing things that make your home more viable and coupled with concierge services and things that, you know, make, like you and I'm laughing because I'm sitting in my courtyard right now, and I've got our pillows. Lillian made these pillows for the Four Seasons Valhalla pillows. That because that's our mindset. We go through, totally your articulation of it, that we don't want to do any more at home than we would do if we were staying at the Four Seasons. We've adopted that. Yeah. We have a we have a logo and everything. We refer to our house as the Four Seasons Valhalla.
Yeah. One of my goals for our properties, because we have, you know, we have Chicago, we have Toronto, and then we have Falls Lake. And one of the significant improvement projects every single year.
Yes.
Improving what you have. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I could have learned this from you probably when I first met you, but the last 2 years have indicated to me that residential real estate in certain places is a really good investment.
You think? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true, isn't it? It's so funny.
Our cottage property, we bought it in February of last year. Okay, we have one cottage, but the cottage next to us with 2.5 acres came up, and we haven't done a thing with it. The value went up 80% in 1 year.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we're going to tear it down. We're going to tear it down, but we didn't get around to tearing it down, and the value went up 80%. Here in the city, I don't know what it is, but I got to believe it was very significant. Not so much.
Oh, I bet.
Chicago is too close to a place where there are 10 shootings a day.
I was just going to say, isn't that like where it's one of those places that did Illinois have a net loss migration?
Well, they lost 2 congressional seats. That tells you everything you need to know. And last
there you go. That's it.
That's a bad sign for a state when it loses congressional seats, because, it's like, at the very, very least, it's like you lost 1 million in population.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And 2, it means you've lost very significant population. There's an interesting thing about the Constitution. A lot of people don't know, but the number of congressional seats never increases. That is 435.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's an amendment to the Constitution. It's in the 20s. I think it might be, in the 24.5. I'll have to go and look. And do you know why it's 435?
I did know, and I forget.
It's all the seats that they can actually fit in the building.
Okay, we can start this, but I'll tell you what, I repeat, we are not adding any new seats to this building.
No, I mean, they tried, but the House side of the Capitol building, you have the Senate on one side. And 435 was it. You can't get more than 435. And so
that
they said, well,
funny.
That should be a law. And that kind of shows you how laws are created. We've ran out of room. Let's make it.
They're probably
law.
And agreeing. No, totally. Okay. Yeah. No, we agree with that. That's fine. We'll just keep the districts the same. Right.
Yeah. So the thing is, they've got 50 states, that have, they have the seats. And the 435 are divided a demographic basis. And so every 10 years they have a census, and the number goes up. The total number of Americans probably went up 10 million. I don't know what the number was. So they take the new number, divide by 435, and then look at the states and say, who gained population, who lost population. And your state, every census now forever gains about 2 seats every 10 years.
Yeah.
And New York is in a total continuous loss situation. Most of New England is in a continual loss situation. Mm-hmm. Midwest, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, they're losing population. Texas gaining population, Arizona, So the... all the places that are pleasant during the winter time for aging and dying baby boomers gain seats.
Yeah.
Except for California, for the first time in its history, lost lost a seat. And that's because of almost impossibly bad government.
Yeah. Welcome to Florida.
Yeah.
And the hotspot, Texas and Florida, are the two powerhouses now in the United States.
Texas and Florida, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Happy to be in
two
one.
Two states that used to be dog parks and ranches. That's what those two states were. And now they're powerhouses.
You see? This is good news. This is good. You can't go wrong in cottage country either. You can't go wrong in Muskoka.
Yeah, and
I think
the population is the only problem right now is if you try to. We have spent the last 2.5 years trying to put a veranda on our first cottage. You know, it's just it's about a 10-foot by 40-foot, you know, screened in porch, you know, with screened. It's not glass in, it's just screened in because we don't do much during the winter. And it took us 2 years to get it through the local housing.
Why?
You know why? Because
no.
They can't make a decision unless they're in person.
Oh, wow.
They can't. Four of them can't. There's four of them that have to make a decision, and they can't do it on Zoom. There's no provisions in their ground rules that they can do this by Zoom. Although they could have a meeting, in the parking lot where each four of them, they each have a car window, so the four of them, they could be kind of like in a circle. They could make a rule to change the rule that they could do it by Zoom, but that's big stuff. Yeah, that's big stuff, making a decision, that you can make a decision by Zoom. How do we know that's really the person?
That's crazy.
How do I know you're not just a recorded Dean?
Well, there's no reassurance, Dan. Unless you have the Turing test and ask me something only I would know or something. I guess that's...
But you see, based on the historical inventiveness and originality of their discussions, they can't tell whether it's recorded or not.
Even when it's live.
So anyway, it took us 2 years, and then the supply chains, we ran into the supply chain problem, just getting wood, just getting...
Yes.
Yeah, and everything like that, So anyway, this is a big shift. The other thing is that 80% of, I believe, North American supply chains, which were offshore, in other words, that something that you wanted in North America had to come from someplace in the world, 10 years from now, 80% of that will be in North America.
I'm noticing that with Amazon now, noticing microcosms of that in a way that you're noticing everything being positioned to serve these little zones here that I know their logistics have gotten really good in their distribution of where they warehouse things, that I've even had situations where at 10 o'clock at night, I could order something and it tells me you can have it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Which is still, it is kind of, I'm just realizing what an amazing,
it just means that warehousing is going to be everywhere.
Yeah, warehousing and all of that. But the big, there's so many, there's the real things that are, everybody's telling me they're struggling with is finding people to work, to do the actual, everybody loves the partaking in the convenience, but not many people like providing the boots on the ground effort to maintain that convenience. Like it takes a lot of, I just think about sitting here on the couch outside in the courtyard shopping on Instacart for Publix to have somebody bring the food, bring the groceries right to your door, or to have somebody cook stuff for you and bring it right to you. All of the bring it right to you.
Here's my thesis. You know, there's all sorts of theses about there being so many unfilled jobs going. This is like historic. Yeah. They've never had this many unfilled jobs in the history of the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy has never had this many unfilled jobs. And there's all sorts of theories about this, you know, starting with it just shows you how lazy people are. It just shows you, you know, that the government is bribing them to stay at home. I mean, there's all these theses. And I said, I said the COVID people staying at home gave them time for the first time, because and realized that before they were just too busy and tired to know how shitty their jobs were.
Wow. Yeah.
If you give them a week's good sleep, and you give them some time to think about it, they said, "I can't believe I ever did that job." You know, I can't believe that. You know, I would travel an hour to get to home, and I can't believe I did. I did that when I went on the longevity trip to Boston and New York with, you know, I flew business class, and we stayed at the Four Seasons and the Mandarin Oriental with it. And about five times during the trip, I said to myself, I can't believe I ever put up with this.
I know, exactly. You are so right. It's even just for meetings that are outside of, it's just such inefficiency.
Anyway. Yeah. Two things. I don't know if Eleanor contacted you, but could you send us your schedule for Breakthrough Blueprint for the?
I will. I got the email from Eleanor, and I will. Yeah.
Yeah, send it, because I have one somebody here in Toronto. Definitely, I said I won't talk to you anymore if you don't do Dean's workshop. I said you can't talk to me. You can't use up me until you go and do Dean's workshop. So.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah, I've got one. I'm gonna do a live coming up in December. I'm going to see what the first in Florida at Celebration.
Okay.
And,
That'll work. I'll get in touch with this person. I mean, he's a great guy and everything like that, but, he's trying to how his way into the future. And
I got you. Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I said, look, I said, I can't. Nothing I say is going to make the least bit of difference until you reframe your whole thinking about where the profit is in your whole process.
Okay.
And I said 3 days with Dean and you'll have a totally different view. And
perfect.
You know, so anyway, the other thing I want you to know, just, you know, to make sure that this is not a terrible physical tribulation for you. In February, we're planning to have a live free zone summit at the end of February, and it's going to be at the Four Seasons in Palm Beach.
Oh my goodness, that's close.
Accommodating,
like that. I'm very familiar with the Four Seasons.
Your courtyard
in Palm Beach
experience.
Yes, this is good. I like
you can
that.
Even hire someone. You can even hire someone to drive your Tesla there, and you know, whatever.
Yeah, this is great. I love that. Now I'm very. That's very exciting. The Four Seasons in Palm Beach, so good. I like it. It's a nice.
I've been there. I mean, it's not one of the grander of their hotels. But,
no,
I mean it's very quiet. It's very quiet.
Yeah,
right on the beach. It's nice.
Yes.
And so, you know, and everything. So, so we, you know, in some places, Phoenix was, you know, you could just forget it for the next year, you know, getting any hotel space or anything. So, we did that. Are you going for Genius Live?
I'm not. I'm virtual, yeah.
Yeah, we're going because
We're going to Canyon Ranch too, so we're
okay,
going
right.
to see if we can repeat our normal. This would be our normal thing, and so anyway, we'll be there. Ben and I are going to do a live. They're going to do a Q&A. So Tuesday, Gap and Gain is released by
Hayes. I know. I saw that. Very exciting.
Yeah, and our sales are way above last year, so we're off to a better
what's
start.
What's the website what's the website that people can go?
GapandGainBook.com. GapandGainBook.com.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I love it. I got mine already. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's...
what's the next one now, too?
10 times.
10 times.
2 times.
Well, that's great. I got to.
Yeah,
I got to go with that. Yeah, I'm going to continue.
Start our first. We start our first work on it on Friday. You know, so and but the big thing is we got interviewed by Reed Tracy from Hay House.
Publisher.
And he said the interesting thing about how he said without any marketing for the last 7 months, we're not how it's selling at the same rate right now than it was 7 months ago, and it was so
it's going to be a perennial. It's one of those.
He said it's the dream of every publisher to have a self-selling book, and he says you got one here.
Yeah, that's the best because that's, and I think it's only going to grow as people, you know. That's
and then on Amazon, when they, you know, with the new book, the Gap and the Gain. They just automatically link it backwards. So they show the Gap and Gain, and then they immediately take its cover and pair it up with House. So,
that's so great. Yeah. I can't wait to see this next one. I told you it's my express purpose to be the who was the filmmaker that would be cameos in his own films. He was in every one of them. Orson Welles, yeah.
Oh, Orson Welles, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to be the Orson Welles of this 10-book series with a cameo appearance.
Yeah, you have a whole section. We have your entire rules for, how you would like your life to be.
I saw that, yeah. I know I'm being successful with.
Yeah, you're like the Zelig of all my future books.
There we go. Perfect. Oh, man. All right, Dan. I always enjoy these. Perfect.
Okay.
Thanks, Dan. Bye.